Around the world, as some aspects of life slowly start to resemble normal, there are many questions for company founders and their teams on whether customers and clients will return in numbers as before the pandemic. There is, though, great uncertainty across all sectors, hospitality, entertainment, and retail to be certain. But commercial aviation is an area with the biggest question mark right now. As borders start to reopen, are people feeling confident enough to jet off for a summer holiday? And with slashed company budgets and a commitment to keep people closer to home or working from home, will a drastic reduction in business travel be for the long run? The economic impact in recent months has been massive, and it's still unclear how much worse things could get. We've seen the large bailouts and huge job cuts announced by major airlines in recent weeks, but some airlines may be grounded for good. Adding to the pain here in Europe has been the UK government's introduction of a two-week quarantine period on travelers entering the country. British Airways, along with low-cost carriers EasyJet and Ryanair, have already announced legal action. It's an example of government restrictions that mean for people who want to fly, they simply can't. One of the more vocal critics of the quarantine plan has been Wizz Air CEO Jozef Váradi, who called the measures pointless and harsh. Flights to and from Britain are important for the airline, which has otherwise done pretty well in weathering the coronavirus storm. They're even pushing ahead with planned deliveries of new planes and to open new routes, including soon to Abu Dhabi. But how is that possible given the current climate? You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. First up this week, here's my conversation with Jozef Váradi, who joined me from just outside Budapest to talk about how the airline has fared so well and what's in the works for the future when the aviation industry is fully operational once again.
You know, we have been running this business not only for profit, but also for long-term resilience, trying to pile cash up to make sure that, you know, as it is a cyclical business, it's a cyclical industry, you know, we can weather the storm, whichever direction the storm is coming from. I mean, of course, no one knew that it would be a pandemic, it would be a coronavirus, but I don't think it was totally unexpected that something might be happening that would significantly affect the industry. So we have been building quite a significant cash reserve in order to create long-term resilience. So, you know, at the time when coronavirus broke out, you know, we were the most profitable airline in Europe. We were the lowest cost producer in a commodity business, and we had the highest level of liquidity. So I think once you have that position, you start looking at life slightly differently. And of course, we had to do what we had to do given the circumstances. So we had to adjust capacity to the new realities, and the new realities were not necessarily dictated by underlying consumer needs. Of course, consumer needs came down as a result of the pandemic and some scare, you know, in the minds of people, but mostly demand got constrained by restrictions imposed by governments. And unfortunately, it all happened in a very uncoordinated way, either at European or global level. So I think that has prolonged the crisis, and it has made it far more costly than otherwise. But we have been kind of looking through the jungle throughout the whole period. And it's not only that, you know, we were winding down capacity, but also we were looking at ways of how to rebuild capacity and what we need to do in terms of actually taking advantage of the market, making investments into new markets, which will mature over time. So we have always been having this kind of a double thought. You know, we were very rigorous when it came to taking measures needed to manage the wind down, but also we have been fairly optimistic and upbeat when it comes to looking at new market opportunities. And here we are now. I think Europe is at a turning point now. In June, we are seeing significant capacity to be resumed. We are seeing a lot of the government restrictions falling away, and we have started making announcements for new activities, opening new bases, new routes. So actually, we are quite excited. And I would just say one more thing here, that, you know, the pandemic is one issue, and obviously it's very unfortunate, it's very sad what has happened to a lot of people and how that affected people's life. But I would also say that the hysteria and the panic around pandemic, coronavirus, you know, are another set of issues. And, you know, that might have blown things out of proportion. But probably even more importantly, if you look at the following economic recession resulting from coronavirus, I think that's going to be making a profound impact on economies and industries. And really, this is the situation we are setting ourselves up against, how, you know, to manage this business in an economic downturn, which I think we are sort of already into, but it's coming, and to make sure that when the market consolidates, when the industry contracts, we, being one of the strongest players in the industry, take advantage of that market consolidation process.
Well, that's really interesting, because I think you've said that, you know, a third of global airlines could potentially fail out of this crisis. Commercial aviation is very competitive, of course. So it's not seen in that world that this is a bit opportunistic, perhaps, that you could put your hand up and say, hey, we are ready to take those gate slots, or to open up new routes, or to move into new airports. So how do you see this going forward in terms of opportunity?
Look, I mean, I think the fact that, you know, when there is an economic downturn, that triggers market consolidation. I mean, that's totally predictable, and you can really strategize it. So, you know, we are in a commodity business. In commodities, lowest cost prevails. And, you know, throughout the whole period of the company's operation, this has been the overwhelming spirit and drive of our business, to get this business delivered at the lowest possible cost, lower than our competitors, because we know that, you know, that gives you the most resilient position, and it gives you the most opportunities going forward. So I think it's been on strategy completely, that, you know, in a way, we were predicting that an economic downturn would happen. And we know intellectually, you know, I'm an economist. I mean, one of the first things what you learn is that economies develop through cycles. And you know that in the cycles, you know, some people will suffer, but some will take advantage of. And, you know, you certainly want to make sure that your business is on the side of those who actually can take advantage of the situation. So I think we have been preparing ourselves for that for a long, long time. Now, with regard to the very opportunities as they arise, yes, I think we are opportunistic to some extent. I mean, you know, we are seeing a number of airports coming to us pretty much begging for our capacity, because, you know, we are, if not the only airline, but certainly one of the very few ones who actually can deliver incremental capacity to airports, and all others are contracting capacity. So obviously this gives us a significant advantage. You know, we are seeing airlines kind of diminishing slowly, or, you know, contracting in a big way, leaving markets behind, and, you know, we would be there to backfill that vacuum. So you sort of screen around your markets, and you also look at your markets, and you kind of rank these opportunities up, and, you know, you pursue those which you think are attractive enough short-term, but also sustainable over the long run, and you would be acting on those opportunities. So, yeah, I mean, we don't have a predetermined agenda in terms of, you know, these are the very markets we want to enter or we want to grow. I think we want to give us the opportunity to actually observe what's happening, to see exactly how these opportunities manifest, and make up our mind on that basis.
Well, that's very interesting, because I wanted to ask you about which markets you might move into next. Of course, you work at all different sizes of airports, from major hubs to regional airports. So how do you focus on expanding those routes? I know Abu Dhabi is one that's coming up, but what about more regional markets?
Right. I mean, it is basically decided on the basis of a few critical parameters. I mean, obviously, you look at, you know, the attractiveness of the market from a long-term demand perspective. You look at the competitive dynamics of the market, and certainly you look at the scalability of the market, whether, you know, if you enter the market, can you scale operationally, can you scale from a brand perspective, and you look at the cost of operations. And I think once those parameters are put on the table, you can form a pretty good view whether, you know, this is an investable market for the long run, or this is just a short-term opportunistic move. We don't really do short-term opportunistic moves. I mean, it may seem to be opportunistic, but at the same time, I think every decision we make is very considered, and it is derived from a long-term perspective and from a sustainable business conduct perspective. So I think that's just the way we do it. Now, I don't think we are going to change strategy here with regard to the types of markets we want to be in. I think we love secondary airports. We love regional markets. I mean, Wizz Air has created a regional center in Eastern Europe, which was sort of non-existent before our entry to those markets. I mean, we put a number of regions, a number of airports on the map of aviation, and we want to continue to do that. You know, we are looking at opportunities within Central and Eastern Europe, but also we are looking at opportunities in Western Europe and going further east. And Abu Dhabi, as you said, is a good example of what we are trying to do. You know, we don't think that a well-established ultra-low-cost carrier model has been put up in the UAE, and we think that, you know, we have a unique opportunity here to bring in a model that works from an industry standpoint and from our standpoint, and also it adds a lot of value to the country, which wants to diversify its economy away from carbon. And, you know, we could be a very significant lever to achieve that objective. So that is a perfect strategic fit between the objectives of the parties. And that excites us. And, you know, this is a fairly recent development. And, you know, those developments or similar ones like that, you know, could happen in the future, and we would be ready to move. I think overall we are, you know, very eager to carry the flag of low-cost flying, to liberalize air travel, democratize it, you know, to give the opportunity to people to move around and fulfill themselves. And that objective is very important to us for the long run. But interestingly, we are also seeing quite a lot of opportunities arising from existing very established markets in the East. Maybe the best example of that is the establishment of three Western European bases over the last couple of years, starting with London Luton, based on the creation of Wizz Air UK, which is a new AOC airline. And then we entered Vienna, and now we are entering Milan Malpensa. I mean, these are mature, well established markets, but we're seeing that we can add value to the market, and you know, we can scale ourselves, and it makes sense for the long run of our business. But these are very contained kind of actions. I mean, we are not moving away from regional secondary airports to primary airports. We do some primary airports, but the focus will remain on secondary and regional airports. And geographically, while we are doing a bit more in Western Europe, the focus will stay and remain on Central East Europe, as well as going further east.
Well, that's very interesting to hear. You know, your approach, very measured, and it just comes down to good business planning, I think. But what about in the cases where there are still some unknowns? Obviously, countries are opening up at a different rate. Some are still hoping to attract summer tourists. We don't know if people will be confident enough to fly. Will they be able to go anywhere this summer? How do you deal with that part of the market and dealing with sort of the cash flow in the short term?
But, you know, the good news, at least from our standpoint, is that we entered this pandemic situation with 1.5 billion euros of free cash, and, you know, contemplating the worst case scenario that we are not able to fly a single flight, we are not able to fly a single passenger, we will still be in business in 2 years from now. So we are very strong on liquidity. And as a result, we don't need to take short-term desperate measures for survivors. I mean, we are taking all the measures needed based on good and prudent business practices. But, you know, we have a balanced view on how we are running this business. Now, the problem today, I think, is much more around the restrictions as opposed to people's desire to fly. We have done quite a lot of demand sensing on our own customer database, and also we looked at third-party databases. We looked at Google and, you know, some other travel-related companies' databases to, you know, to understand, you know, what people are searching, what desires they have to travel. And I can tell you that I think people want to go, they want to move, and especially after having been locked down for 3 months, I mean, they want to breathe fresh air and they want to go to the sea and enjoy the sunshine. And also we are seeing that people who are, you know, on split families and, you know, people working abroad or studying abroad, they want to go back to their place. So there are certain traffic flows that will emerge back fairly quickly. I mean, of course, there are traffic flows which will keep dragging, like corporate travel. I think it will keep dragging, not necessarily because of the pandemic, but it's because of the following recession. I think elderly travel will suffer because those people are most affected by the pandemic itself. You're going to see a mixture of the situation from a consumer demand standpoint. But, you know, our business is much relying on young travelers. We carry the youngest customer in terms of average age, 36. Every other airline has a more elderly customer base. And we are, you know, much on VFR kind of traffic, and that's the first kind of flow which will come back to normalize the level. So I think we are in good position to capture re-emerging demand, and given our cost base and our health and safety, updated health and safety protocol, I think we are also able to give a lot of confidence to people that, you know, they should travel. It should be attractive from an economic standpoint, but also from a health and safety perspective, air travel is perfectly safe for people. And, you know, what we are seeing is that we have a few countries that now we are operating 60-70% of the original capacity, and we are achieving around 70% load factor. I think that's pretty good. I mean, given the situation that has been characterized by lots of restrictions here or there, and still, you know, we are able to capture over 50% of the previous passenger traffic. So, you know, I'm very hopeful that consumer demand is not going to be the profound limitation in the system. But as you say, it is a bit of a mess with regard to restrictions. They tend to be fairly unpredictable. Countries act on their own decision, I mean, really in an uncoordinated way. And, you know, a country may go left and then the same country may go right in a few weeks. So it is a very unfortunate situation from a regulatory perspective and, you know, from a planning perspective. Having said that, I sense that June is now turning the tide. I mean, we are seeing the southern countries already opened or getting opened. We are seeing continental Europe kind of lining up for a restart mid-June or 1st of July. And there are some peripheral countries that are taking different courses of actions, like the UK just introduced quarantine, and some further eastern countries' measures are still very restrictive there. So it is not going to be great, but I think it's now moving to the right direction. But the way you can plan for this is that, you know, you are on standby, you stand ready to move, and if you can, you do. If not, then you need to defer. But our aim and our planning is basically acting on an upbeat scenario that whenever we can fly, we will fly. So we are not playing games, and we are not making many assumptions. We are looking at the regulatory framework as it is actualized, and we are acting on it. But you know, our interest is to resume flying to a maximum extent and as quickly as possible.
You know, you talk about a little bit about the randomness of those restrictions that do come in. I did want to ask you specifically about the UK. You partially answered my question there, but I'm just curious in a business sense. You're quoted in the FT as not being very happy about what the UK government has planned for the 14-day quarantine. But what does that actually mean for you in a business sense? If you know, people can't book tickets, people can't fly for work, people can't fly home to see their families. What does that mean in actual numbers?
Well, I mean, it can go, you know, if, you know, the original demand was, let's say, 100, and, you know, current demand in a kind of a liberalized environment with not overwhelming level of restrictions probably would be around 60-70% as we speak. You know, that can take demand down to like 10-20%. So it is profound. It is huge. So it basically takes 70-80% of demand away. I mean, that scares people off, and basically a measure like this, you know, makes the purpose of travel quite redundant, because I mean, you go to a country and, you know, you look yourself for 2 weeks, then why are you going to that country? So, you know, it is difficult, and the problem with all these quarantine measures is that it is doubtful that it achieves anything. The fact of the matter is that there is not a single proven case in the world that would confirm an infection aboard of an aircraft. So flying an aircraft is not infectious. I mean, the quality of air in a plane is comparable to the quality of an intensive care unit of a hospital. And the way air circulated, basically, it pushes the air down vertically. So the likelihood of infection is almost zero. I mean, let's not forget that, you know, humanity has been encountering, you know, infectious viruses millions of times. I mean, this is not the first time it happens. I mean, this is the first time the world reacted to it like this, but you know, infectious viruses are not unique at all, and people have been traveling for 100 years. I think the industry has figured this out already, how to create a very healthy environment for air travel. And you know, the whole industry has kind of upped its standards when it comes to health and safety. You know, we are making obligatory to wear masks. We have eliminated touch points. We do a lot of deep cleaning, the infectious cleaning on the aircraft. We distribute hand sanitizers free of charge, all those sort of things. So I think flying is very safe. So when you put up a measure like this, I'm not sure what you are achieving. I mean, you know, if you want to check people out, you can still check people out when they arrive to the airport, or, you know, they should be obliged to, you know, to produce a negative test. Some countries have done this, so you were able to travel should you have been in possession of a negative test result in the last 72 hours. So I think there could have been put some alternative measures in place that could have been actually more effective than just blindly putting everyone into quarantine, which basically means that you are eliminating air travel for the time being.
Yeah, Mr. Rowdy, I've taken quite a bit of your time. I just had one last question for you. You know, you started in the aviation industry in and around September 11th. You've pulled Wizz through the global financial crisis of a decade ago, and this crisis, the size of it and the length of the economic impact, still unknown, of course, but you continue to plan new routes, to take delivery of new aircraft. It seems like prudent, good financial planning has paid off for you. But you know, people talk a lot about the low-cost sector and how it is actually able to survive. You seem quite positive about that moving forward. What do you think the place of carriers like Wizz are as the aviation industry sort of pulls itself back together and builds again?
Well, you know, I think, you know, flying is becoming increasingly a commodity. And in commodities, we all know, across sectors and industries, lowest cost prevails. And, you know, this is the position Wizz is at, and this is the position Wizz wants to retain for the future. So I think we will stay very focused, very measured, but at the same time, we are eager to grow, we are eager to expand, you know, in terms of size, scale, in terms of a geographical footprint. So I think what you should expect from Wizz to deliver in the future is to be a bigger and more impactful airline, but you should not be expecting Wizz to change its business model and its approach to the business and the consumer. We think it is very important that we create a sustainable efficiency in the industry that gives you the basis for low-cost travel, and you know that is combined with your continuous drive of innovating your business in terms of technology, including aircraft, including, you know, consumer technology. So I think you have to be always updated when it comes to going with the flow, how consumer behavior changes. I think you need to be in the forefront of those changes that should drive those changes. So I think you can expect Wizz to be more on the leading side of the industry with that regard. But I don't think you should be expecting Wizz to become the next British Airways or Lufthansa or long-haul, low-cost or whatever. I think we're going to be very measured, and we're going to be sticking to the model what we have been implementing. You know, that model has made us successful, and I see no reason why we should profoundly change that model going forward, because, you know, you would be undermining your historical success factors. But at the same time, you know, you have to stay relevant, and you need to change, and you need to adapt to the changing environment. But I think this is more the challenge on the technology side, and better recognizing the changing needs of consumers.
Very well said, and I appreciate you speaking frankly. Thank you, Mr. Rowdy, so much for your time.
No, thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yosef Varadi, CEO of Wizz Air. Now, as cities open up and lockdowns ease, heading back to the office will be a welcome change for many. But of course, this pandemic has raised lots of questions on how to keep people safe and feeling comfortable on the job. Beyond social distancing and better hygiene practices, coronavirus has certainly added nuance to the whole future of work conversation. For more on this topic, we hear now from Bruce Davison, who is CEO of London-based firm GoSpace AI, which helps businesses to get the most out of their space, thinking about everything from environmental impact to cutting costs to boosting productivity. He says leaders must now prepare for an office revolution. But as you'll hear from Bruce, beyond data, technology, and AI, which is very helpful, design still very much requires a warmth and human touch.
The office is on the verge of a revolution. Leaders must prepare. Following the global pandemic, businesses must understand the need to provide greater flexibility for their staff. The world of work will have changed forever. Home will be a normal place of work. Teams will not always want nor need to be together. Commuting will be seen as a waste of time. It will be an opportunity to look after people as well as reduce unnecessary overhead. It cannot be simply open season, however. People being given carte blanche doesn't work when office space and working environments are involved. Until now, we had either given everyone their own desk or office and seen half of them sit empty every day, or created free address environments where people wasted hours every week booking space, trying to find each other or work together. Excessive planning and self-organization have both failed. Instead, we must now gather data and intelligently understand and plan how our teams can best work together in a world where people are enlightened, yet cautious, and organizations need to reduce costs. The old ways will no longer work. The technology we need to create a new purpose must be implemented today.
Bruce Davison, CEO of GoSpace AI. Now, we've talked about travel and the office today, but what about you and what you're actually working on? Lockdown and a brutal economic picture has meant all businesses have needed to adapt. We've talked about rethinking the mission and finding opportunity. But this whole experience has been deflating as well. So finally today, a word from a familiar voice, Nils Leonard, the founder of London agency Uncommon Creative Studio. As you'll hear now, hope is an important motivator to find the next level, or to find the courage to do what you've always wanted to do.
Creatives are dealers in hope. They're in the business every day of seeing something that isn't really there, and yet believing that one day it might exist. Now, the only thing more powerful than fear is hope. And our job as leaders is to set this creativity free in everyone around us, to bring hope to bear in a time when it's easy to get caught up in fear and doubt. It's a cunning facet of this virus that it exposes the true human weakness. Our inability to be alone, isolation, is kryptonite to progress. So make calls, stay noisy, and refuse to let a colleague just be a name in Helvetica on a Zoom screen is their voice and face you need in all its wide-eyed bedhead glory as we all try and find our way into the light. A low-res cackle can conquer the biggest doubts. Lastly, as we retreat from this virus, remember not to hide from life. We're going to exit our castles to a very different world, but the plans we hatch in yogic stillness or the rosy warmth of Netflix now might well be the greatest leaps we make. Lethargy, cynicism, and doubt are viruses too. Remember, the quickest route to failure is never to start. It's time. On the tough mornings, you'll just want to put the laptop in the fridge next to the Encona and go and ruin the decals on your TV remote. In these moments, don't look to company purpose. Look to yours. The reason you started it all in the first place, the reason you accepted, or the reason you know you're going to leave. The itch. The thing you think about 2 days into a holiday. The dent you really wanted to make. It might be time.
Nils Leonard, founder of Uncommon Creative Studio. Nils is always a great source of inspiration on thinking about the bigger picture. You can hear my full chat with Nils on episode 386 of The Entrepreneurs. Do check out Uncommon's work online, their projects during this pandemic to support healthcare workers, the hospitality sector, and mental health awareness have been inspiring to follow. Well, that's all for this week. My thanks to all our guests and to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.